Typically, they start out with a skin cell, and by upregulating certain transcriptional factors, certain molecules in the cells, they've been able to create cells that very closely resemble human embryonic stem cells. It's a bit like turning lead into gold. And if perfected, we will no longer need any human eggs or any of the controversy associated with destroying embryos.
That's Dr. Robert Lanza, Chief Scientific Officer, Advanced Cell Technology, talking to the Associated Press about the discovery, actually a breakthrough, they're calling it, in two separate laboratories, the ability, they're saying, to take human skin cells and produce stem cells very similar to embryonic stem cells without even going through the human embryo. That would be a huge step forward, not only scientifically, but also ethically in the whole stem cell debate. We're going to be talking about that and another issue, the cloner of Dolly the sheep backing off on human cloning. Dr. David Stevens joins us from the Christian Medical Association here for the first few minutes of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. You can join us for the next 3 hours as we come to you live this Tuesday, November the 20th, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Or email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. In the second half hour of the program, Tony Watkins will be joining us. I've been getting so much email about this book and this movie, The Golden Compass, and I watched the trailer for the film that's coming out in December. It's amazing. It's kind of a Chronicles of Narnia-esque, Lord of the Rings-esque fantasy, but some are concerned because the author of the book is a pretty outspoken agnostic slash atheist, and he says he didn't think much of Christianity. We'll try and make sense of this in the second half hour of the program. At 4 o'clock, some audio open lines. We'll talk about a new pro-family ad by Mitt Romney. He, of course, is responding also to some push-poiling that brings up the issue of his Mormonism. We'll hear a Fox News story on that. At 4:30, the problem of evil will be the subject as Greg Kokel of Stand to Reason joins us. And then in the 5 o'clock hour, we'll talk about the worldview of postmodernism, continue our conversation with Ken Samples, author of the new book, A World of Difference, Putting Christian Truth Claims to the Worldview Test. Dr. David Stevens is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He's CEO of the Christian Medical Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. Dr. Stevens, welcome back to Issues Etc. Oh, we'll get him here in just a moment. Our call-in number is, by the way, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727 or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Stevens, welcome to Issues Etc.
It's great to be with you.
Is this the great news that it sounds like, being able to get embryo-like stem cells without human embryos?
This is the biological equivalent of the Wright brothers flying the airplane and lead being turned into gold. It's big news, and I think it's going to have a tremendous impact on the debate. In fact, those involved in embryonic stem cell therapy are scrambling, trying to tell everyone, well, we still have to do both, we're not sure which way it's going to go, etc. But you can tell that this is going to really affect the debate over what's being going on with embryonic stem cells in this country.
We've heard fantastic claims about human cloning and all sorts of breakthroughs before, and some of it has turned out to be entirely bogus. But this sounds like this came from two different directions, two different labs, and the breakthrough is genuine.
It is genuine. It was actually done for the first time in mice about 6 months ago. But, of course, there's lots of things you can do in mice you can't do in humans. You can clone mice, but it's nobody's been able to clone a human being yet. Because it's so much more difficult. And what they did in this instance was essentially take a skin cell that has all the genetic information, like every cell in our human body does, needed to make a whole human being. But most of that genetic information has been turned off. It's kind of like having a CD that only is playing one track, and that's kind of what a cell does. This cell is a skin cell, so it only plays the skin cell track, the genetic information for that. What they did was actually put some viruses into the cell carrying four genes, which caused all the switches to turn differently, and it began acting like an embryonic stem cell that has the potential to turn into any type of tissue of the 210 different types of tissues in the human body. And that opens lots of doors for research and therapy without the ethical issues of destroying a human being.
Why are those who are the advocates for embryonic stem cell research, this destructive type of research that requires the destruction of a human embryo in order to harvest the stem cells, why are they, at least it sounds like to me, trying to pour cold water on the announcement?
Well, most of them are saying we need to do both. But the reason they're saying that is because they already own the patents on the procedures developed for embryonic stem cell research using embryos. And they're wanting to commercially make this successful. So they're saying, well, we can't be sure which is going to work. This may work for one thing. Ours will work for another. These are for-profit companies and large research universities that survival depends on getting research dollars and grants and other things. So they are really scrambling trying to make sure the money doesn't turn off.
I heard someone this morning, not a scientist or a researcher, predict that if this is true, the clamor for and then the funding for embryonic stem cell research with all of its ethical problems may in fact dry up within a decade. What do you think?
I think it could, and perhaps in a shorter period of time than that. You know, there was news this week that they had cloned the first primate, a monkey. And when you talk about primates, that's humans and higher apes, monkeys and gorillas and things like that. They've never been able to do that. And that came out in the news late last week. And now it's just passe information. So what? Because, I mean, it took them hundreds of attempts. They were only able to develop two embryonic stem cell lines from the clones. One of them was genetically abnormal. They haven't been able to get it to turn into the type of tissues they want. What we found through all this research, unethical research on clones and embryos, is that embryonic stem cells are very, very difficult to work with. They're hard to culture. They're very difficult to control what type of cells they become. They are genetically unstable. They mutate. They turn into cancers. Even if you are able to solve all those problems, you still have to clone the patient and create their genetic identical twin, their brother or sister, grow it to 6 or 7 days in the laboratory and destroy, essentially fratricide, killing your brother, to get the cells you need for treatment. Forbes magazine estimated if it did work, it'd cost over $200,000 a patient. You'd have to customize the therapy to every patient. And the list of problems just goes on and on. With this, as somebody stated today, the procedure that was described by the Japanese laboratory could be done in 1,000 labs tomorrow in the United States. They already have the technology and the abilities to do that. And so this just opens the barn door for research, for funding from the federal government, and for getting cures quickly, which is what all of us want, not something that's pie in the sky maybe 10 or 20 years down the road.
Talk, if you would, about the real successes in research and cures that have been found with non-embryonic stem cells and with what are usually called adult stem cells.
Yeah, adult stem cells is a term which is almost a misnomer in the sense that it also includes stem cells gotten from the placenta and umbilical cord. It's essentially any non-embryonic source of stem cells. So these cells that were developed today are adult stem cells by definition. Already using those methods, cells from bone marrow and other tissue in the human body, umbilical cord or whatever, there are over 1,200 studies in patients already going on. Research that's already being, where they're trying things out to see if it'll cure a heart attack or whatever. If you look at embryonic stem cells, there's not one clinical study going on. No research actually involving patients is still in the laboratory working with animals because it's so dangerous and it's so difficult to do. So we're seeing that to cure the diseases that involve the destruction of tissue, diabetes, heart attacks, strokes, and the list goes on and on. Where we're really seeing results are with adult stem cells, and this new method opens the ability to essentially take a skin cell from patients and create cells that could treat them in the laboratory for a host of diseases, along with these other therapies that are already being developed. So we're making huge strides, and none of it involves human cloning, and none of it involves using embryonic stem cells.
Dr. David Stevens is our guest. He's CEO of the Christian Medical Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. We're talking about using human skin cells to produce stem cells without creating human embryos, a major breakthrough being announced by two labs this week in two major scientific fora. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc at kfuo.org. On the subject of cloning, the most famous cloned animal ever, Dolly, and his or Dolly's cloner, I guess. I don't know what word to use there. Certainly not creator, but cloner. Ian Wilmot, he has recently had a change of heart on human cloning. Tell us about it.
Yeah, he actually, just based on the mouse studies that happened about 6 months ago, converting skin cells into embryonic type stem cells, said he's given up cloning. He's not going to do it any longer. He realizes it's a dead-end street, it's too hard, it's impractical, it's too costly, there's not enough women's eggs around to clone human beings, nobody's been able to do it yet after 6 or 7 years, so he's given it up, and he's going to put all his efforts into using the technology of reprogramming skin and other cells into embryonic stem cell-like cells. They act like embryonic stem cells, but they're not, and they aren't taken from embryos. So he's going to be moving that direction with his whole institute in England, which I think is the first, he was the first one to do cloning. I think he's one of the first ones to get out of it, but I think he's going to have a log jam at the door as he leaves the cloning laboratory, because I think more and more people are going to be doing that in the scientific community.
What does this change of mind, change of direction for somebody like Ian Wilmot say in the face of those who continue to tell us, both in the media and in the biotech industry, that the only sure way for cures for terrible, debilitating diseases is to continue through one form or another, either cloning or IVF embryos, destroy human embryos and harvest their stem cells for research?
Well, I think it's a slap in their face because, I mean, he's been the icon of that type of research. Obviously, he's not leaving on moral grounds, but I've been saying for the last 4 or 5 years that we'd probably win this battle in the laboratory, not in the marketplace of ideas, because too many people have been convinced by the hype from embryonic stem cell science that this is the only way that we can get cures that they want. I think we need to now hold these people accountable who have manipulated public opinion, changed scientific norms in the sense that before them we did not destroy one human being even to save another, and have wasted millions of dollars of taxpayers' money in California and other states. And say, listen, can we trust you the next time you tell us something? Because you fed us a bunch of bunk, and it's not worked. And because of that, we're further behind than we would have been if we had followed the righteous path to adult stem cells. I think they've made this political correctness issue, and if you did not support embryonic stem cells, you didn't belong in the scientific fraternity, you weren't a true science, you were anti-science. They've said that about us here at the Christian Medical Association. And, the bottom line is science has proven what we said is correct.
Let's talk about the money aspect of it as well, because I am a private, let's say I'm a private investor, and I want to put my money into biotech, and I've been told that embryonic stem cells is really the way to go, and there's so little federal funding for this stuff. They really need my money. What do I need to know before I spend a penny on somebody's research in embryonic stem cell research?
Well, biotech investors are pretty savvy. A lot of them have scientific backgrounds. And interestingly enough, Jeff, that is the reason that they had to have the California referendum and ask for $3 billion is because biotech investors weren't biting off on this stuff. They were saying, this isn't going to work. It's too difficult. We're not going to give you money for this and waste it. And so that's when they went to rob the taxpayer coffers in California to fund this type of research. I think what biotech investors thought has been validated, and I think the few that did experiment in this area are going to be much more reluctant to put any money into this type of work because it just doesn't have the potential for a financial return, which is the bottom line for them.
It's a little cynical, but to think of these things politically, the timing of the announcement we discussed earlier really couldn't be better, given the fact that the United States is about to choose another president within a year, and doing so would, in one form or another, either stay the course that this president has set for federal funding for embryonic stem cell research or radically change that course. What will 2008 mean when it comes to this?
Well, this has been a huge political football, and the president has been painted as anti-scientific, anti-cure, doesn't care about people, unfeeling, uncaring, et cetera, and it's been a hot political issue. It was in the elections last year. I think this news is going to begin to silence that. I think some people are going to use the old rhetoric because it's worked, but increasingly I think the issue of what's happened this week is going to be brought up, and over time those critics are going to be silenced and remove this political issue from the table. And I think rightly so. President Bush has put in hundreds of millions of dollars into adult stem cells, and we're already close to therapy for many new diseases and already treating many with adult stem cells, and he should be credited for that. His bold moral stance had a huge impact on how people's health is going to be affected in the years ahead.
What's the next announcement that you anticipate now that we have, several months ago, as you said, had an announcement with regard to being able to get stem cells from mice tissue without going through and destroying mice embryos, now human tissue without destroying human embryos? What would be the next step in the research that would say to you, this is going to prove successful and this is going to prove kind of the answer both scientifically and ethically to embryonic stem cell research?
I think what we're going to be hearing in these papers, they actually converted the cells they had created into beating heart muscle and into brain cells. I think we're going to see a host of new cells being developed of different types of tissue. One of the the holy grails is to be able to create islet cells. Islet cells are the cells in the pancreas that make insulin and could deal with the 20 million diabetics we have in this country. I think with this ready, accessible source of a limitless supply of stem cells to experiment with and to convert into the type of tissue people want, we're going to see many breakthroughs and new tissues being announced. We've created this type of cell or that type of cell. That'll quickly move into testing in animals, in animal models, and then within 3 to 5 years, we're going to be seeing clinical trials using these type of cells, combined with what's already going on in adult stem cell research. We are seeing a new dawn of medicine and what we call regenerative medicine, where before many patients died of acute disease, now most patients die of chronic disease and damage to cells. And we're going to see ultimately people's lifespan increased and their life quality increase because of what's happened this past week with these new cells.
Finally then, Dr. Stevens, put it in a nutshell for our listeners. What's been discovered and why is it good news?
We scientists have been able to reprogram skin cells, which we have in a limitless supply, into embryonic stem cell-like tissue that can become any tissue in the human body. That's going to open the door for cures for many diseases which patients die of now and usher in a whole new era of medical treatment. I think we can be excited, we can be thankful, and we can support it because it doesn't involve destroying human beings.
Dr. David Stevens is CEO of the Christian Medical Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. Their website address, cmda.org, cmda.org. Thank you so much for being our guest, and I hope next time we talk to you, we can be talking about some of those steps forward from this new discovery.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
There is a world where witches rule the northern skies, where ice bears are the bravest of warriors, and where every human is joined with an animal spirit who is as close to them as their own heart.
Are we going to see the child?
I should think so.
But this world is dominated by the Magisterium, which seeks to control all humanity, and whose greatest threat is a golden compass and the one child destined to possess it.
Maybe it's just because I don't have little kids in the house anymore, just teenagers, but the first I heard of the golden compass was a couple weeks ago. We were actually in central Wisconsin at a pastor's conference. A young pastor approached me at breakfast and said, "Are you going to do something on the golden compass?" And I thought to myself, well, if you'd tell me what it is, maybe so. And then I started getting more and more email from people saying, "Are you going to say something about the Golden Compass?" Well, it's a children's book and a forthcoming movie. You just heard a bit of the trailer starring some pretty big Hollywood names. And in watching the trailer this afternoon, I was blown away. This looks like a real amazing fantasy story. Now, the concern that people are raising is that the author of the books upon which the film is based in part, Philip Pullman, is a pretty outspoken agnostic slash atheist, depending what time of the day you talk to him, and he has said that it's made it his business to undermine the basis of Christian belief. We're going to be talking with Tony Watkins here in just a moment on Issues Etc. about this children's book and the forthcoming movie, The Golden Compass. You can join us with questions or comments if you've read the books or seen the books, if you're anticipating seeing the movie or are worried whether you should. We want to hear from you. 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850. Or email us here in the studio as we come to you live this Tuesday, the 20th of November. IssuesETC at KFUO.org. IssuesETC at KFUO.org. We'll begin our conversation with Tony Watkins here in just a moment. We have talked about the Harry Potter books. We've talked about the Lord of the Rings trilogy, about the Chronicles of Narnia. All of these things have been brought to the big screen to our children's attention through Hollywood, and all of them have been, to one degree or another, controversial because they deal with matters of fantasy. And when the issue of witches or wizards come up, Christians are rightly cautious at first. Now, many Christians concerned about the fantasy world where witches and wizards walk the streets, many of those concerns have been allayed in the case of the Harry Potter books or in the case of the Rings trilogy, and certainly many Christians have no worries about the Chronicles of Narnia. Well, why? You look at something like the Harry Potter series and you say, she may not be the kind of Christian I am, but J.K. Rowling is a espoused Christian, J.R.R. Tolkien, a Christian, and C.S. Lewis, yes, a Christian. What if the same kind of fantasy world is constructed for our children in books and film? But the author is an outspoken agnostic or atheist, as is Philip Pullman. The stories are compelling. The characters are amazing. It keeps our kids' attention. It has just as much play in the box office. But should Christians, because the author is against Christian belief, enjoy this as entertainment or have anything to do with it at all? I want to hear from you as we begin our conversation on The Golden Compass. 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. Email us. This break is a good time. IssuesETC at KFUO.org.
Defending life from beginning to end.
You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Jeff Gibbs, on why a man should consider studying for the pastoral ministry.
Three reasons come to mind. The first, Christ needs pastors for his church. This is the way God works. He chooses men to be under-shepherds, to guide and to feed his people. Second, the thought of being a pastor is a joyful thought. Intimidating, to be sure, but great joy is out there in front of you as you consider the possibility of studying for the ministry. Third, other respected Christians have looked you in the eye and said, I think you should study for the ministry. For these three reasons, you might consider studying for the holy ministry to be a pastor in Christ's church.
For more information, check out the logos for Concordia Seminary in St. Louis and Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, at our homepage, issuesetc.org.
Does Hollywood address the abortion issue?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Much to the chagrin of abortion advocates, Hollywood screenwriters often refuse to advocate abortion. In the recent hit movies Waitress and Knocked Up, two women face unplanned pregnancies, but neither woman even discusses not having the baby. The word abortion is never uttered. While Hollywood is liberal on most social issues, abortion rarely comes up in films. Producers generally realize the topic is not popular with viewers. As the president of one entertainment group put it, abortion is not big box office material.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. For more about our work to mobilize and advance pro-life women in politics, visit our website at sba-list.org.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, where values thrive, and online at thrivent.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Today, President Bush pardons the national turkey. If the turkey could think, it would wonder what it had done that needed forgiveness. Simple answer, it's not what you did, but who you are. You are a turkey. How do you determine what you need forgiveness for? Psalm 19 says, who can understand his errors? Dietrich Bonhoeffer suggests a way to lead us to a better understanding of our need for forgiveness. He writes, the guilt we must acknowledge is not the occasional mistake or going astray, not the breaking of an abstract law, but falling away from Christ, from the form of the one who would take form in us and lead us to our true form. For example, it's not that I cussed, but that even my civil speech often falls short of Christ's pureness. Again, our good deeds often include some selfish calculation, whereas Christ's love is totally selfless. Keep thinking like this, and you will understand St. Paul. Here is a trustworthy saying that deserves full acceptance. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the worst. 1 Timothy 1:15. Again, Bonhoeffer, genuine acknowledgement of guilt does not grow from experiences, but for us who have encountered Christ, only by looking at the form Christ has taken. It's a rare turkey who gets pardoned.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, online at thrivent.com. We do more than work. We work with a purpose.
There is a world where witches rule the northern skies, where ice bears are the bravest of warriors, and where every human is joined with an animal spirit who is as close to them as their own heart.
Are we going to see the child?
I should think so.
But this world is dominated by the Magisterium, which seeks to control all humanity, and whose greatest threat is a golden compass and the one child destined to possess it.
That's a little of the trailer of that forthcoming film, a December release of The Golden Compass, based on one of the books of Philip Pullman. We're going to be talking about Pullman and the Golden Compass here for the next half hour or so of Issues Etc. Tony Watkins is our guest. He's a speaker, a trainer, and workshop leader for Damaris Trust, an organization that helps people relate contemporary culture and the Christian faith. He's author of the book Dark Matter, shedding light on Philip Pullman's trilogy, His Dark Materials. Tony, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Is the story of the Golden Compass itself anti-Christian?
Well, that's a tricky question to answer, actually. If you take it in the context of the trilogy of books as a whole, then you have to say, yes, it fits in with an overall anti-Christian feel to the trilogy. But this first film on its own, I don't think it is, because New Line have quite deliberately taken out or toned down the religious aspects of it. So I think this film is a safe film. What the next two are going to be like is a little bit more tricky.
What about Pullman himself, the author of the trilogy? How outspoken is he with regard to the Christian faith?
He's very outspoken, yes. He has very little time for it at all. He concedes that some good things have come from it, but he thinks that religion in itself is a malign force. He was brought up to be a Church of England, typical Church of England person. For a while, he lived with his grandfather, who was a vicar in the Church of England church, but he turned away from it as a teenager and now has really quite a strong anti-Christian feel to his whole life. He's a member of the British Humanist Association and so on.
How is the Dark Materials trilogy anti-Christian in its storyline? You mentioned that the first one is rather tame and rather subtle, but as the trilogy unfolds, and certainly this film will probably have its sequels, where will the reader or the observer begin to detect an anti-Christian bias in all of this?
In the first book, you begin to get it a little bit, because in this alternative world where the first book is set, the authority, the government, is a totalitarian religious authority, which feels very much like a caricature or an exaggeration of the Catholic Church today. Or perhaps Catholic Church at periods in its history, would be safer to say. And towards the end of that book, you begin to get the feeling one of the characters in particular is very opposed to God. But that's only just beginning to become explicit right at the very end of the book. In the second book, it becomes more explicit, where we discover that that character is mounting a rebellion against God himself. It's a continuation of the angelic rebellion that John Milton wrote about in Paradise Lost, and Pullman very much sees himself as retelling the Paradise Lost story and its continuation. And then in the third book, it becomes very explicit, where one of the characters in particular used to be a Roman Catholic nun from our world and has renounced her faith, and God himself gets killed off. Now, that's quite strong, isn't it, when God himself is killed off? Pullman says that it really is an attack on authority more than an attack on religion, though he doesn't like religion. And Chris White, the director, has said that's the line I want to take with the films. I just don't see how they can do that consistently with the second and third films.
Is God a character? Is God himself a character in the trilogy?
Yes, he is. Yes. God turns out to be an angel, in fact, who's the first angel who tricks the others into believing that he created them, which is an interesting move because it does allow him to re-envision angels as kind of physical beings. There isn't really a spiritual dimension, you see. Everything is physical. But angels are composed of the raw materials of consciousness, I guess, and it allows him to kill off this chief angel, God, and leave aside the question of where everything actually came from.
So, if let's put this in the context of its intended audience, or one might say its intended audience, the young child or the slightly young adolescent who would be picking up these books and reading them for the first time.
Yes.
Would a person coming from that perspective readily detect where the story is going and what the ultimate message of the Dark Matter, the Dark Material trilogy is?
I think that varies from one child to another. I know many children who've read it. I think it's pitched at young teenagers probably, but obviously some younger children read it. And many of them say, we can see where, Christian children say, we know where he's going with this. We can see that he doesn't like the church. But that's, you know, that's fine. We can separate fact from fantasy. This is just a story. And he can say all kinds of things in the story, and it doesn't make them true. So they're not worried by that at all. And children who are not Christians, again, are able to say we can distinguish between fact and fantasy. I think the problem is not so much what he actually says in the book, but the kind of feeling that he engenders towards Christian faith. And then when he says the same kind of things in interviews in the real world, then it muddies the waters rather, because kids read the book and they love the books and they say, this is great and fantastic stories. He's a brilliant writer. And then they read an interview with him in a newspaper and discover that he's making exactly the same kind of attacks on Christianity.
Is it aimed at Christianity in particular, according to Pullman?
No, but he says, when he talks about himself as an atheist, he says he's a very special sort of atheist. He's a Christian atheist, because the kind of God that he doesn't believe in is a Christian version of God. And in particular, he's a Church of England atheist, because that's what he grew up as. So he says, I am reacting against something very specific, and it's what I know, but I am against religion generally. In the second book, one of the characters' real list of names that God has supposedly used for himself, and it includes various Hebrew and Christian names for God, and he was criticized by somebody, in a church leader in Britain, for not including Allah. And Pullman says, oh, that was a bad mistake. I better make sure that's included in the next edition, which he did.
So he's equal opportunity irritator of the religious.
Yes. Yes, you could say that. Yes, doesn't want anyone to be left out.
In the story itself, in the world of the Dark Materials, this fantasy world, is there any references, clear references in the book to matters explicitly Christian, to Jesus Christ, per se?
Jesus gets two mentions, very brief mentions, and they're both from this nun that I was mentioning just now, Mary Malone. And he's only mentioned in passing because she's describing the story of her loss of faith. When I interviewed Pullman and asked him about what place he had for Jesus in his thinking, he has a great respect for Jesus as a moral teacher and as a storyteller and as a great figure in history, but he says that he doesn't accept the things that have been said about him. But he says, I do have a place for him in my thinking. And he's currently writing a book called The Book of Dust, which will fill in some of the gaps in the story. And at least when I spoke to him a couple of years ago, he thought that he would include in that book what he calls his creation myth. He says when he was writing his Dark Materials, he had to keep stopping and thinking, how does the background to all of this work? Kind of like Tolkien inventing his history of the elves. Pullman had to write his creation myth, the story of the angels and how they came into existence and so on. And he says that I do have a place for Jesus in that myth. And in fact, he puts Jesus even on the side of those people who are opposed to the misuse of religious authority, which in a sense is absolutely right, and in another sense is a little bit wrong.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on The Golden Compass, you can give us a call now, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I know many of you have been anxious for us to talk about this. You can send us your email as well, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Tony Watkins is our guest, a speaker, a trainer, and a workshop leader for Damarist Trust, an organization that helps people relate contemporary culture to the Christian faith, author of the book Dark Matter, Shedding Light on Philip Pullman's trilogy, His Dark Materials. The book and the forthcoming movie, The Golden Compass, is all over the place. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live this Tuesday, November the 20th, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. In your conversations with Pullman, I've read through the transcriptions, and it's a bit of a sparring match between the two of you.
Yeah, it was fun, actually. I think we both enjoyed it.
Is his atheism, I kind of classify atheists in several ways, some who have made a real ardent attempt to think their atheism through and mount arguments in favor of their atheism. And those who are casual atheists who haven't really thought the atheism through, where does Pullman fall on that continuum?
I think he's a thought-out atheist. I don't think, well, I'm not sure he started out as one. I still feel that although he says that it was an intellectual decision to abandon his faith, I think it was, I suspect that it was motivated by emotional issues that were tied up with the death of his father when he was seven. Pullman himself denies this and doesn't like it when people suggest it. But it seems to me that it's difficult to get away from those kinds of issues, I think, as a teenager. And I wonder whether he has rationalized the process of what was going on then and made it into an intellectual thing when it wasn't entirely intellectual to start with. But these days, he's a well-thought-out atheist. And as you can see from the interview, he's prepared to ask some tough questions. He spent the first half of the time we had together asking me questions. and then we had to pick up the interview proper and me ask him questions.
I'm curious because no one who enters this very popular genre of literature, especially in these longer serial forms, like J.K. Rowling or Pullman, can possibly be unaware that they're walking in the footprints of people like J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. Mm. Does Pullman express any connection, affinity, or relation to those two great writers of fantasy trilogies and fantasies?
No, not really. A reluctant one, I guess. He doesn't like Tolkien at all. He tells a fun story of the one time he met Tolkien, because Pullman was a student at the same college where Tolkien had been a lecturer. Tolkien had retired by the time that Pullman was there, but he had dinner with him once. He was invited to dinner with the master of the college and the great Professor Tolkien. And Pullman and his friends were there, sitting either side of Tolkien. And Tolkien turned to one of them and said, "Are you enjoying Anglo-Saxon?" And Pullman's friend said, "No, actually, I'm not." So that wasn't much of a conversation for Tolkien. So he turned to Pullman and said, "And have you read my book?" And Pullman said, "No, I haven't." And that was it. That's his connection with Tolkien.
Hmm.
So he doesn't like Tolkien. He thinks that it's psychologically very uninteresting. But he hates Lewis with a passion. He says that the Narnia stories are an ugly, what does he say, an ugly vision, a peevish blend of racist, misogynist, and reactionary prejudice, which is quite strong. He likes Lewis as a literary critic, not as a fiction writer. He doesn't like the way that Susan is not allowed into Narnia at the end of the story, for instance. He says that Susan is condemned to hell for liking lipstick and nylons, which is not really what Lewis is saying. Lewis is saying that Susan has become worldly, has lost her faith in Narnia, and maybe she'll get there later. But Lewis reacts very strongly against anything that he doesn't like in it, and doesn't really have any time for it at all. It's amazing how hostile he gets when you ask him about Lewis.
That's interesting, because the comparison that people are making more often than with Tolkien is with Lewis and Pullman.
Yes.
They're saying this almost is kind of a dark Narnia story that he's telling there.
Well, that's right. And the times when Pullman seems to hint at the fact that he is writing a rebuttal to Narnia, and at other times he says, "No, it was nothing to do with it. I just wanted to write my story." And I think it probably is the latter, but when people do ask him about Narnia, he tends to, in that context, see his book as quite a strong answer to it.
Ruth is calling from Dallas. Ruth, thank you for being patient, and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you. I'm wondering, would you know of a book called The Golden Bough, which also had a very dark view of things and promoted an anthropological view of the liturgy, and it was taught by a liturgics professor at Neshota House to my husband, and he walked out.
Ruth,
do you know that at all?
Thank you. Do you know of it, Tony?
Yes, I know of it. I've never read it, but Pullman himself read it, I believe, and has been influenced by it to some degree. And I've actually not read it myself.
What is your advice? This is where people will always kind of stop in the conversation whether it be the Harry Potter novels or any others that have been controversial with respect to Christians. And they'll say, okay, obviously page-turning novels, obviously great storytelling, but should we read them? Should we let our children read them when it comes to the Pullman books or the Pullman film?
I would say, in general, yes. I think, obviously, with children, it depends on the child. But I don't think we need to be afraid of people mounting strong arguments against Christian faith. Maybe things are different over in the States, but over here, the vast majority of people in Britain are not Christians, and those people who are Christians are constantly finding themselves having to deal with some fairly hostile challenges against their faith. I don't think that what Pullman puts into his books is radically new or particularly difficult to deal with, but they are fantastically written. They have some very high moral values. Pullman himself says that what he was wanting to do with anything is to examine the questions and to make the questions burning ones in our minds. The questions about, is there a God or isn't there? And Pullman's conviction clearly is that there isn't, that there is no afterlife, that he keeps saying there ain't no elsewhere, this world is all we have, and so on. But he says these, the most important questions of human existence, are religious questions. And so he says in this trilogy, as well as a couple of his other books, he really wants to examine those questions. And he does so in such a powerful and a wonderful way in terms of the quality of the literature that I think I would say, yes, get on and read them. Enjoy the quality of the writing. Let him raise the question. Don't turn off your critical faculties. Don't let him carry you along with his rhetoric and his occasionally snide remarks against religion. But be critical. Be thinking about what he's saying. Be thinking about the moral values and be thinking about the worldview issues. And then at the end of it, say, that was a great work of literature. I'm glad I read it. I totally disagree with where he's coming from. And now I'm in a better position to talk to my friends about it.
It seems ironic that writing from an avowed agnostic/atheist viewpoint, that Pullman would construct a fantasy world wherein God is a character and where he feels the need eventually to kill off that character. I would think a consistent atheist would, if he was going to write fantasy, would write a fantasy where God is entirely absent and nothing is thought or said of him at all.
Well, you would, wouldn't you? I think it is very interesting. In some ways, I'm not sure that Pullman knew where he was going to end up. Overall, he did. He knew that he wanted to write, as I said already, an extension of Paradise Lost. So the idea of a rebellion against the idea of God, at least, I don't know whether he intended right from the start to kill God off in the way that he does. I think to some extent, as he really got into his stride with the trilogy, he allowed his worldview to become more and more explicit. I think it's one of the reasons why many people, Christians especially, enjoy the first book and don't enjoy the last book very much, because the gloves are off in the last book, and he gives in to propagandist statements from some of his characters, whereas in the first book he's much more restrained. He's more focused on telling the story than making philosophical points. I think my feeling is he's just got a little bit carried away and given in to some of those things when he should have held them in check a little bit more and might have written a stronger third installment as a result. What's more interesting, I think, than the fact that he brings God in as a character is that he smuggles the idea of God in a different way, because what controls everything at the end of the day in this trilogy is stuff that is called dust with a capital D, rather than the stuff that you have to sweep off your piano every day. And this dust has theological meanings, because it turns out that it's the stuff of consciousness, and it permeates the entire universe. But this dust collectively somehow is intelligent and controlling and almost sovereign. It guides, it directs, it is the ultimate in reality. And actually, what he's created with the idea of dust is not very far away from the idea of God. And he has to smuggle the idea of God back in to make the whole thing work. And that, I think, is particularly revealing.
You talked about kind of the preachy, propagandist nature of the latter books. It strikes me that for someone who criticizes C.S. Lewis for doing the same thing in his Narnia Chronicles, he seems to have fallen into exactly the same trap that he says Lewis did.
Well, yes, that's right. There are many people, including some reviewers who share Pullman's atheist convictions, who say that he has fallen into the same trap as Lewis and that he has got propagandist. I do think that to some extent. I think he's been careless in the way that sometimes Lewis was careless in his writing because he wrote so quickly. I don't think Pullman is setting out to be a propagandist. He says, I'm out to tell a story, not to preach a sermon or to write a philosophical treatise. But he gives his characters a little bit too much leeway sometimes. He just allows them to say too much.
Tony Watkins is a speaker, trainer, and a workshop leader for Damaris Trust, an organization that helps people relate contemporary culture and Christian faith. He's author of the book, Dark Matter, Shedding Light on Philip Pullman's Trilogy, His Dark Materials. Tony, thank you very much for giving your time and for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Folks, I want you to notice something. In this last hour, we've dealt with two very timely issues. The new report on using human skin cells to create stem cells without destroying human embryos, and this forthcoming movie, The Golden Compass. Now, if you appreciate the timely nature of Issues Etc., please consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift. Now, any size gift is deeply appreciated. You can donate to Issues Etc. online, our website address, issuesetc.org. You can donate by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. You can donate by check. Write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Now, thanks for keeping us in mind as we approach the end of 2007. When we come back from this break, we're going to be doing a little audio open lines for you, your questions, your comments, a new pro-family ad by Mitt Romney. He's answering some criticism that's coming in the form of push polling as well. We'll have a Fox News story on a telemarketing survey that Romney claims is anti-Mormon. That's all coming up on the other side of this break. Then after audio open lines, Greg Kokel will join us to talk about the problem of evil. A lot of atheists have been made out of the problem of evil. And we'll see how Greg Kokel, what he says is, it's not so much an argument against the existence of God as for the existence of God. After that conversation with Greg Kokel, we'll have Ken Samples, as he was with us yesterday, so he'll be with us today, continuing our conversation on worldviews. Yesterday it was naturalism. Today it's going to be postmodernism. It's a slippery subject, but we'll hopefully deal with it and compare it to the Christian worldview, coming up here in about an hour on Issues Etc. That'll take us up to 5:30. The last 15 minutes of the program is audio open lines for your questions and your comments. Tomorrow, we'll talk about thanks and thankfulness in the Scriptures. Dr. John Seleska will be our guest. Frank Beckwith will also join us to answer the question, can a Christian vote for a Mormon? Picking up on something we're going to deal with a little bit later here in the program, in fact, on the other side of this break. I like the advice that Tony gives. We've got a real page-turner, a real spellbinding story here in The Golden Compass. Now, if you know full well it's written by an atheist, guess what? You're well prepared to enjoy it as, insofar as you can, it might not be your cup of tea, but you're well prepared to enjoy it as an interesting story. You know where the author's coming from. You know the truth is on your side. You know he has an axe to grind. Isn't this kind of what we do almost all the time with everything we read? Heck, if we had to wait for all our good stories to come from Christians, we'd be waiting a long time and the bookstores would be mighty empty. So you walk in, you read the story, you enjoy it for the good story that it is, the compelling story that it is, and you know full well where it's headed, and you know full well what his agenda is, and you know full well that you have the truth on your side. You don't have to be afraid that somehow you're going to find something in The Golden Compass that's going to completely destroy your faith. We'll be right back with Audio Open Lines.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.